Nein, nein!
I'd like to call the committee to order.
Hey, thanks.
We have a quorum. And members, while Representative Halverson comes in the room here to present her bill, I just want to mention to the committee, and I know that you all are aware, we have a very ambitious agenda for today. And most of these bills should be relatively non-controversial. And we're really going to try the best we can to get through them. Some of them are going to be going to the Finance Committee. And so, as you know, the Finance Committee will discuss the cost of the various provisions. And so I just want to really focus members' attention that we are doing our best to get through a number of issues, and we would really like to move things along as best we can. So we're going to ask all of our testifiers to be very brief in their comments and to understand that many of these bills have other stops and we're close to deadlines, and I just am really asking everybody to focus on the task at hand and be very brief, both members and testifiers. So with that, first of all, we need a motion to approve the minutes of February 26th.
Madam Chair?
Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes for February 26th, 2013.
All right. Thank you. Representative Benson moves to approve the minutes of February 26th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you, members. And Representative Halverson, you are not on this committee. Okay, I confuse the Finance and Policy Committees. I'm sorry. So I will be happy to move Representative Halverson's bill, and that is House File 262. So I will move that House File 262 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. So welcome to the committee, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lori Halverson, and I'm here today to present my bill on spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury program. This is being titled the Jablonski-Roderick Spinal Cord Injury and Traumatic Brain Injury Program. I come to this issue as a former caregiver myself. I was a caregiver for people who were living with disabilities due to spinal cord injuries. This bill was originally brought to the legislature by a constituent of Senator Hayden. The constituent was Matthew Roderick, who brought this legislation forward on behalf of his son Gabe, who was injured 4 years ago at the age of 15. And we'll get to hear from Mr. Roderick later today. The bill itself is fairly simple, and it calls basically for an appropriation of $8 million in the next biennium to be spent on research on spinal cord and traumatic brain injuries. The Commissioner of Health would create a board of experts and community members who will study the research that's being performed in Minnesota and would make recommendations to the commissioner on the distribution of those funds. The bill's not prescriptive on the research. The board of experts who know the issue best are the ones who are going to make the recommendations to the commissioner. So it's not something the legislature is going to be doing. I've got just a few very brief comments to be respectful of your time. But I did want you to know that in Minnesota, over 100,000 people are living with a disability as a result of a traumatic brain injury. And every year, about 300 Minnesotans are living with a disability as a result of a spinal cord injury. In the United States, I think it's important to notice as well that our service members are being directly affected by traumatic brain injuries as well. And in the U.S., more than 250,000 service members come home with traumatic brain injuries as a result to injuries that they've received in combat. A lot of people feel like this is an underestimated number, that there's a lot more folks out there who are going undiagnosed, living with traumatic brain injuries. annual health care costs for these folks for a lifetime, living a lifetime with a spinal cord injury is about $800 million. That's math I can't even do. And annual health care costs to the state are estimated to be around $2.3 billion for folks living with spinal cord injuries and traumatic brain injuries. There is a precedent to this type of state funding. It's not super common in Minnesota, but in 1985, the legislature did appropriate money for the study of Alzheimer's disease. And 14 other states in the country have approved research appropriations for spinal cord research. There are Minnesota doctors who are experts in this field, who one of whom will testify today that we're really, our research is really advancing to the point where we are able to find effective treatments for people who are living with spinal cord and brain injuries. It's important to note that these treatments are vital to supporting people with disabilities to lead vibrant lives. A lot of people think that there's only one goal, and that's cure, but I think that we also know that these doctors are working on a lot of different treatments that can support people who are going to be able to live the most vibrant lives that they're able to with their disability. So with that, I would like to invite, and Madam Chair, I just wanted to make a note that I was approached by another citizen who wants to be heard on this issue, but has promised to keep it very, very brief.
Thank you.
And with that, I would like to invite Matthew Roderick to speak to this issue.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you.
Just please state your name.
I will. Okay. My name is Matthew Roderick. I am the father of half of the namesake of this bill, my son Gabriel, who's here somewhere hiding. Gabe. And I just want to quickly, I promised many of our supporters that I would drop this with a flourish. It's our petition of roughly about 1,200 names, mostly from Minnesota, but also from places around the world that support this effort. 4.5 years ago, as Representative Halverson said, my son was injured in Costa Rica on a student exchange program. Blink of an eye, body surfing, something I did most of my summers as a child in South Jersey Shore. But instantly blew up the fifth vertebrae of his cervical spine, rendering him quadriplegic. I won't go too much into our story. I know we're on limited time. But suffice to say that most folks, please go ahead. Most folks don't know, you know, when they see someone in a wheelchair, they don't realize, particularly with a spinal cord injury, how devastating and complex an injury it is. Most people think that person can't walk or they can't use their hands, but the fact of the matter is it affects absolutely every system in the body, from cardiovascular system, endocrine system, etc. And again, I won't bore you. I'm really here after 4.5 years of quite literally traveling the world in pursuit of the best rehabilitative option for my son, the best regenerative option for my son. And in that time, I've done quite a bit of research, and while I can't claim to be an expert, I know quite a bit more than I did 4.5 years ago. And what I urge you to consider is that, this being the Healthcare Policy Committee, I believe that CURE is good healthcare policy. Essentially, that's why I sit before you. And when I use the word cure, I don't use it naively. I mean very specifically. Cure is intentional, but is also understood, as Representative Halverson said, it's staged. And the research that is going on is proving to show benefit in stages of recovery, stages of regeneration. And that's where I think we are. In simple terms, the research follows three stages. It's basic science, it is translational research, and then it is clinical research. In Minnesota, we have a number of labs currently that are in the latter half of stage two, that translation of basic science into treating humans. And really what we need is a little injection of money to bring that to clinical research, which is getting it into people, and people who desperately need it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We have a couple of other testifiers.
Hi, my name is Mike Jansen, and I just want to quickly say that you know, when you break your back, you break your neck. Doctors can repair your bones, but they can't repair your spinal cord, and that is not good enough for me. It's about time we change that. I've been in this chair for 29 years. For 23 of those years, I've been heavily involved with a group that is working for a cure for spinal cord injury. So I know both the devastation of spinal cord injury. I also know the promise of our current state of cure research. There are people who will tell you that it's more important to fund just care and maintenance programs than it is to fund cure. And I think that's a very short-sighted argument. To fund care programs only and not fund cure is condemning all of us and millions of others who will follow us in spinal cord injury to a lifetime of paralysis. The money that this bill is asking for is, as you've heard, a drop in the bucket compared to what you're spending on care programs. Care alone is never ending. It goes on and on, year after year after year. At some point, we need to bite the bullet and give cure research the funding that it needs to succeed. While care and maintenance are a bottomless cesspool of money and misery, cure only has to be paid for once. And once you have it, everything else goes away. You don't need any more cure or research funding for spinal cord injury. You don't need any more care funding for spinal cord injury. You don't need. You won't have the devastation and misery of spinal cord injury anymore. All gone. And I think that's something that's worthwhile doing. The state of Minnesota wants to be a leader in medical research. This country needs to be a leader in medical research. This bill, this funding, will help put us there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Representative Hall. We also have, Madam Chair, Antonio Comas, who wishes to be heard on this issue.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, thank you. My name is Antonio Comas, and back in 2007, on February 19th, I was hit by a freight train, and I suffered a severe TBI, and my life was drastically changed because of that. Like, my five senses were heightened. Like, when I get scared, I feel terrified. When I'm sad, I'm crying. It's just a terrible result of that, and through mine, I got to experience the hyperbaric chamber, the trial. It was research. I got lucky enough to do it, and that chamber, no joke, saved my life. What you see now would be, I would still be here, but I'd be less able to do what I'm doing. My brain is non-functional in a way, so I feel that chamber is very expensive, yes, but that chamber was much needed for my life, and people should get to experience that amazing type of, recovery type thing. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And finally, there is a researcher from the University of Minnesota, Dr. Lowe, who wishes to be heard.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Walter Lowe. I'm a professor of neurosurgery at the University of Minnesota. I've been working in research for treating neurological disorders now for over 30 years. I was the sponsor for the FDA-approved clinical trial for deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease here about a decade ago, and that is now common practice for Parkinson's disease. I'm currently the sponsor for an FDA clinical trial for developing cancer vaccines for brain tumor patients, and so that's in a phase one trial now, and I hope that that will also be a common practice in the near future. So I'm having seen all of these developments in therapies for neurological disorders, I'm excited about this time in science. There are some wonderful things that are on the horizon that I think can ultimately be curative for spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury. We've heard a bit about the hyperbaric oxygen therapy that has been used by Dr. Roxwell at Hennepin County. Dr. Parr at the University of Minnesota is studying different types of cells that will encase or myelinate or insulate other cells in the spinal cord to improve functional outcome. We have researchers at the university that are looking at brain-machine interfaces so that they can record the electrical activity in the brain and then activate robotics to help move and to manipulate things so people can feed themselves. And we even have people that are studying spinal cord regeneration and repair in animals that have that capability in salamanders and so forth. And then trying to decode the genetic programs that are involved in that so that we can activate those same genetic codes and programs in patients with spinal cord injury. So there are some wonderful technologies on the horizon, and I think that this bill here would spur this type of research here in the state of Minnesota to attempt to find cures for these individuals. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. question from Representative Huntley.
Yeah, just a question. What this is, I think, $4 million, and how does that relate to the amount of money that the NIH is currently spending on spinal cord injuries, percentage-wise?
Representative Halverson.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I'm sorry that I do not have that figure, but I'd be happy to get that for you.
Madam Chair, I was wondering if the doctor would know the answer.
And Doctor, I'm sorry, we didn't quite get your name.
Walter Lowe.
Lowe,
right. I'm not sure exactly what those percentages are, but those NIH funds are very difficult to get, very, very competitive. And I've been talking with other groups at Kentucky, for example, who have this type of program. And they've been able to leverage the state funding that they've been able to receive for spinal cord injury to get those particular NIH grants. And so, you know, this is the type of strategy that we're hoping to implement here in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair?
Please, Mr. Roderick.
Just very briefly to accentuate what Dr. Lowe just said, I intended to mention this little stat, but for instance, in California, the Roman Reed Act, who I correspond with, Roman's dad, quite a bit, we're similar. They generated $15 million in state funds. Similar legislation, not exactly structured the same, but that attracted $85 million from both the NIH and some private sources of funding. That certainly is one of the benefits, as we see it, of this state funding, is that it makes a lab more stable financially and with a more financially stable revenue stream, which is a component in that NIH grant process. A lab that may fund and doesn't have may have money dry up is not going to look as attractive as a lab that's actually funded by its own state.
All right. Thank you. Other members, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to this point on the dollar amount, we are seeing and probably will see quite a few more proposals for various money to go to grants. And $4 million per year is a good chunk of change in with our current fiscal situation and difficult budget decisions to be made. And I'm wondering, and what Mr. Roderick just said is helpful. I understand this can be used to help leverage private dollars. I'm wondering, the $4 million figure, is that modeled after another state? You just referenced another state that I think had $15 million. But I'm just wondering if that number is figured because we think we'll get this much bang for the buck if we do that amount, or is there any rhyme or reason behind the $4 million figure or $8 million over the biennium?
Thank you, Representative Mack. And I'm going to let you answer, Representative Halverson, but I do want to remind members that this will eventually, if it clears this committee and the next one, it will go to Health and Human Service Finance. So the ins and outs of the dollar amount will get discussed in that other committee as well. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mack. That's a great question about rhyme or reason. And yes, both looking at what other states have accomplished and looking at what we can gain for that dollar amount were put into the request amount. And I know that both Dr. Lowe and Mr. Roderick have researched extensively what we've done in other states and what we've been able to accomplish for various dollar amounts. And as Mr. Roderick mentioned, Minnesota is coming in low, feeling like we can leverage those dollars well.
And I have Representative Albright on the list, but Representative Albright, was it to these testifiers?
Because yes, Madam Chair, just a brief
ahead,
question.
Representative Albright.
And I'm not sure if this would be applicable for Dr. Lowe or Mr. Roderick, but just curious in terms of what types of research does this grant initiative hope to encourage, or what type of research of any variety would be applicable under these grants? Are there stipulations in terms of what type of research would be part of a grant request?
Dr. Lowe.
Well, some of the examples that I've mentioned, I think, would be things that would be candidates, you know, for this type of funding. Looking at different drug therapies, looking at robotics, looking at repair of the nervous system and spinal cord. So those are the areas that I think would be would benefit spinal cord and traumatic brain injury.
Representative Albright.
And for the author of the bill. you request a $4 million this year and then $4 million for 2015. I'm just curious if you've considered or made note of what the administrative costs that would be incurred on that $4 million, what are we really looking about after the in a sense, the responsibility for the labor to take care of the grants. Have you taken a look at a budget in terms of what the commissioner is going to have to deal with in terms of implement these grants?
And again, Representative Albright, I think that's more a finance question, but Representative Halverson, if you want to address that briefly.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, you are correct. That is a finance question, and that is dollar amounts that we will be working on for our stop in finance. But
then, may I rephrase the question, Madam Chair? Thank you. Then I'll just rephrase it to say, is there a fiscal note attributable to the request or to the bill?
Well, Representative Albright, I think that's kind of the same answer, that because the fiscal note wouldn't be, probably hasn't...
Has it been requested?
Hasn't probably... come in yet, but Representative Halverson, is there a fiscal note requested?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, at this point we don't have a fiscal note requested because the administrative costs are part of the appropriation request. They're not in addition to the appropriation request.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anybody else who wants to testify for or against this bill?
Yes. Okay, watch your toes there.
Welcome to the committee.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Rick Cardenas, and although I've been in this misery for over 50 years, being in a wheelchair, I find it exciting and adventure just to be alive. I know for these 50 years I've been waiting for a cure that has been promised over and over and over again. And actually, while they're on their way, my cure would be I would really like to be 6 feet three and run a 100-yard dash in about 10 seconds. So that's what I'm looking for when we get this cure. I think it's a fantasy that we have to live with when we break our neck and when things happen. We go through a process of grief and what are we going to do about it, anger, and then we look at the solution, which for 50 years I've been waiting for that cure. But in the meantime, I've been up here bugging you folks on various bills and, you know, for over 30 years, 40 years. But so there are things to do and places to see, even if you live in a wheelchair. I'm not against research. I'm strongly for research, but I would like to see more community-based, and maybe we have some of the community now who are saying they would like this. I think the policy that we're looking at is the makeup of the advisory committee is strongly based on a medical model, which is going to look for a medical solution. But there should be a little community-based participation in this. The subjects of that research are not very strongly represented on that advisory committee, and I would suggest that there be a little more community participation in any advisory committee that's established here. Another policy piece I believe is this is a two-year grant, and I think that if this is important, it should be the university that is bringing that in with their budget. Is going to establish a program that will go on and on, maybe for 50 years. For some of those who are freshly injured, they'll be looking for that 6 foot three, 100-yard dash in 10 seconds for another 50 years. So it establishes a new program, takes funds out of the general fund that I see necessary for a lot of community-based programs. And I hope I don't make you angry because I'll be back here suggesting some of those programs later on. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify for or against the bill?
Excuse me.
And
can I say just a couple words?
Yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Deborah Brown, and I'm a recovering TBI patient. So there's just a couple things I wanted to emphasize related to TDI. So my journey first started in November of 2011. After I was in a car accident, I had no idea there was anything wrong. My friends suggested I go to the doctor. I went to the ER, followed up with another doctor, a neurologist who was not familiar with TBI. He suggested and prescribed antidepressant medication, because in the last week, the week between my accident and seeing him, he thought I was depressed. And I'm not a negative person. I'm not usually depressed. I'm very outgoing, and I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to go to work. My friends again encouraged me to seek help at a TBI clinic at HCMC. They diagnosed my disability, or my problem is a TBI, validated all of the symptoms that I was experiencing. And so just in short, just to kind of tell you the impact it had on my life, I could not, even though it was a mild TBI case, I could not care for myself. I'm a single parent. I could not care for my family. I could not shop. I could not cook. I could not carry on a conversation in any meaningful way. I couldn't read. I couldn't watch TV. I was completely isolated. And if I hadn't sought the appropriate amount of help, I'm not sure exactly what would have happened in my recovery process. It certainly would have been extended, and I would have been in a cycle of feeling better, feeling worse, feeling better, and not progressed forward. And so I think that this legislation and learning more about TBI and how it really affects you is really, really important for Minnesota in general, so that everybody can understand and experience the recovery that I experienced.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I think we're ready to vote on the bill, members. Representative Halverson, do you have any closing comment? And then we'll be ready to vote.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for considering this. It's very clear from what we've heard that there's a need in our state and a lot of promise in our state. And I thank you for considering this.
Right. Thank you, Representative Halverson. I will renew my motion that House File 262 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you to Representative Halverson and all the testifiers who came to educate us today. The next bill on the agenda is House File 582, Representative McNamara.
I wondered what that name was.
Madam Chair, representatives.
Welcome to the committee. Representative McNamara, we need to move your bill, and I'm going to move that House File 582 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Madam Chair, I am, as you know, Representative Jay McNamer from District 12A, which is West Central Minnesota. My bill deals with diagnostic imaging for critical access hospitals in Minnesota. I want to express the importance of my bill to rural Minnesota. Last year, the legislature enacted Statute 144.1225, requiring facilities that provide advanced diagnostic imaging services to obtain accreditation from one of four organizations. The requirement is effective August 1st of this year. At the time this bill was being debated, small rural hospitals were given assurance that the Medicare certification through the Department of Health would be sufficient to meet the intent of this new state law. In fact, there is a similar law at the federal level that requires providers to obtain accreditation before being eligible to bill Medicare for advanced diagnostic imaging services. The federal law exempts hospitals from this requirement because oversight and review of these processes is already accomplished through hospitals' Medicare certification process. However, late last year, the Minnesota Department of Health indicated that, as the law is currently written, Medicare certification is not sufficient for hospitals to comply with this law. All Minnesota hospitals will now need to obtain accreditation from the Joint Commission, the American College of Radiology, or the Intersocietal Accreditation Commission for their CT, MRI, PET scans, and nuclear medicine programs. For larger hospitals in our state, this is a non-issue, as many are already Joint Commission accredited. However, the Joint Commission process is not cost-effective for many of the small rural hospitals in Minnesota. Those facilities are the most impacted by the new requirements of accreditation of advanced diagnostic imaging services. As this year's session began, I've heard from a number of small hospitals in and around my district that are worried this law will negatively impact their ability to continue providing diagnostic imaging services to their patients in their area. There are other testifiers here today that would like to talk to this, and I would like to turn it over to them right now.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Burmeister, and I'm the administrator at Windham Area Hospital. We are a 25-bed critical access hospital in southwest Minnesota. We currently provide MRI, CT scan, and nuclear med services that would be impacted by the existing accreditation requirements in statute. We support exempting licensed hospitals from this accreditation requirement because it is redundant. Like almost all hospitals in the state, Windham Area Hospital is Medicare certified, and the in-house CT services provided by our facility are subject to survey and inspection by the Minnesota Department of Health. Windham Area Hospital contracts with Sanford Health to provide mobile MRI services and DMS to provide mobile nuclear medicine services. Both the Sanford and DMS mobile units are Joint Commission accredited, which would fulfill the requirements of the law. However, since the law applies to the billing entity, Windham Area Hospital would have to attain its own accreditation for each mobile unit that provides services at our facility. That means we're required to accredit each individual mobile imaging truck, not just the service. In our arrangements, we would have to accredit two MRI trucks and five nuclear imaging trucks. This adds an administrative burden and additional cost per unit. I want to stress that we're not asking to be relieved of all oversight of the diagnostic imaging services that we provide. Rather, that the Minnesota Department of Health certification process for Medicare conditions of participation for hospitals like Windham Area Hospital is sufficient oversight. I would also point out that we have arrangements with a physicist to evaluate all of our radiation-producing equipment annually to enhance patient safety. Subsequent accreditation through another organization is unnecessary and may jeopardize access to those services for patients in rural areas, forcing our population to seek services some distance away from Windham, or potentially the patient may elect to forgo the procedure. I would urge you to support House File 582, and I'm willing to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions, members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Burmeister. Thank you. You seem very knowledgeable. So I'm just trying to understand, if the services that you're using are JCA accredited, could another approach would have been to say that you have to use services that have reached that standard, and would that be an equally workable bill or approach, or is there something else that's missing? I'm still not understanding kind of what JCA requires that your licensing doesn't, and you did note that the mobile services do meet that standard. So I'm just trying to understand a little bit more background.
Ms. Burmeister.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler. The problem comes in, we recognize that they're Joint Commission accredited, but the way the statute is written, each billing entity has to accredit that service. So it would be a re-accreditation of an already accredited service, the way it's currently written.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question would be, I understand why that would be administrative and complicated and not of much value. I'm still trying to understand if there are hospitals that would fall under this that wouldn't use a JCA accredited service, and what the difference would be. And maybe that's not a fair question for you because you know your hospital situation.
Ms. Burmeister.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would have to do some research to see if there are hospitals that are using other services.
Thank you.
Okay. Maybe Representative Loeffler, we can go on with the testifiers and maybe your question will be answered. And another testifier, are you Mr. Ash?
Yes, thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having us today. My name is Rick Ash, and I'm the administrator of Ortonville Area Health Services. It's a small, rural, city-owned health system with a 25-bed critical access hospital, 64-bed nursing home, a small provider-based clinic, and a small home health agency. So as a rural integrated health provider, we serve the needs of the patients in our community in a variety of services, of course, including CT scans, MRIs, nuclear medicine, and PET scans that we're talking about today. And as my colleague mentioned, last year's legislation session, we monitored the bill that established these accreditation requirements through our legislative affairs staff. And at that time, our staff received multiple assurances that both the proponents and the bill's author that these new requirements were intended to cover non-hospital operators providing imaging services. So as such, we had no evidence that we needed to be concerned or to communicate to our legislators at that time because we didn't believe there was any need to. I can't express how surprised we were when we learned last November that the law currently as it currently stands, these accreditation requirements do apply to hospitals. So as my colleague has previously testified, the accreditation requirements are redundant. Ortonville Area Health Services offers CT scans to patients who need them with in-house equipment. And of course, we also contract with mobile units operated by Shared Medical Services and Centricare to provide those other imaging services that we're discussing. This puts us in a situation similar to, as my colleague mentioned, the fact that both Shared Medical and Centricare are already accredited by the Joint Commission, but we would need to obtain a subsequent additional accreditation on each of those units that are already accredited by the Joint Commission. So That's a challenge that adds complication, duplication, and cost that really don't add any value as we understand it. Another problem or concern that we have is that the law also requires some time frames, and so there may be a delay in our facility's ability to obtain accreditation during this process because the actual volumes that we may experience fluctuate every month. And so the ACR accreditation for scans, for example, would require those with lower volumes to have a certain number of procedures done. ACR requires 3 sample imaging procedures comprised of a variety of different scans from local patients within a defined period of time. And as I said, with low volumes, there are times when, compared to a larger facility, that there would be months that we wouldn't have enough volumes to be able to meet those requirements. That delays our ability to become accredited in those areas and also disrupts our ability to provide that service. So while we don't, we want healthcare to be safe, and we certainly support advancing the safety of our patients and the quality of the care that we provide. Last year's accreditation requirements don't advance quality and or safety in hospitals, and it really serves to lessen our ability to care for our communities. At the end of the day, what we're really asking for in this House file is to put us back to where we were prior to this legislation, to allow our ability to be certified by the Department of Health, who come in, take a look at our systems, our machines, check to make sure our physicists' annual review of the machine and equipment are in appropriate condition, that our biomed people that are checking that twice a year, and that our monthly PM checks are in requirements. So we're already making sure that those systems are working. This would be just the duplication, so we're asking for your help.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Ash. And is there someone else who wants to testify as well, or anyone who wants in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none. Members, any other questions?
Oh,
there's somebody. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please just give us your name.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Linda Lehman. I am not testifying for or against the bill. I am a nuclear medicine X-ray PET technologist. What I would like to see, as long as you're considering the bill, that some clarification is made in subpart 2, number 2, section 1, where it says provisions establishing qualifications of the physician. It's ambiguous because there's many different physicians.
Ma'am, could you tell us a line and page?
Okay,
and line?
I have it at 1.24.
Okay. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay. It says provisions establishing qualifications of the physician. And this can be interpreted as the ordering physician, the interpreting physician, or the physician that owns the equipment. And I think the intent was originally for the interpreting physician. But to, as long as you're looking at the bill, if that could be clarified in your language, it would really help technologists and others that are working with your legislation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. What I would encourage you to do is we're going to need to amend the bill if we're going to make a change there, and I would encourage you to speak with the author of the bill and see if he's willing to make some change there, and then if so, he can do that at a later time.
Okay, thank you, Madam.
Thank you very much.
Ma'am? Madam?
Representative?
We have spoke, and I, as an author, I can make an author amendment, and I would include that as the interpreting physician.
So, Representative McNamara, do you want to amend the bill right now?
I would amend the bill right now and include that as the interpreting physician.
Okay, could you, we need to, if you're going to make an oral amendment, you can, well, you're not on the committee here, so
no.
What, just explain to us very precisely what the amendment would be.
It would be to, if you look on 1.24, it would say, it would be the qualifications of the interpreting physician.
Okay, I would move then an oral amendment to on line 1.24 after the word the to insert the word interpreting.
Correct.
Is that correct, Representative
McNamara? That's correct.
And is there any discussion to that amendment other than what we've just heard? Anybody in the audience or Representative McNamara, do you want to just speak to that a little bit? And
when we do our imaging, we take in, we don't always have a radiologist on staff. In fact, most of our critical access hospitals don't have one. So they are sent into a place to be interpreted. And it would be the interpreting physician that would make the final recommendation on the potential injury.
Okay, a question from Representative Fritz. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative McNamara. You sort of answered it because I was wondering about the interpreting physician is pretty broad scoped, and I'm, you know, usually it's a radiologist.
It's a radiologist,
and
right.
And so I think this will work for now, Madam Chair, but it really is still quite broad in scope as to who is we're referring to here. So I think it needs a little more work, but that's all I had.
Okay. This bill is going to the floor, so we can make an amendment here, and then, you know, this is a little bit outside the scope of what the bill was before us to do, and that makes me a bit uncomfortable about it. That's why I'm wondering if anybody else, does anybody else have questions about this, Representative Morgan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would suggest that if this bill's next stop is the General Register, that we should maybe lay it over and fix it before we send it on, so that we can maybe better understand exactly what the fix is and what it does and get public testimony on it here. That would be my suggestion.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Is there any other, are the testifiers have a comment on this, on making this change?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Ash.
The comment I would leave for you in the committee is that part of this bill has a requirement, a time requirement, that applications be submitted and the process being started, and I believe it's by March 1st, yeah, or very soon. And so my only comment is that from our perspective, time is of the essence to move this forward. Obviously, the committee and the chair will have to take that into consideration, but I offer that for your consideration.
So, Mr. Asher, I take it you're speaking against making this change, because I'm not really clear what you're telling us here.
I'm trying to, I guess, provide additional information from our perspective of a hospital, that because of the issues of time it takes to go through the accreditation, we have to have applications in by the beginning of March, so our time is very short. And I don't know what laying over and all these other things mean, quite honestly, so it's really outside of my scope. I'm just sharing the time is of the essence.
Okay. Representative Fritz?
Madam Chair, I actually have some information on that. I was mistaken. Any physician, board-certified physician, can make this decision on these tests. So I just wanted to clarify that, and that also I'm in support of this legislation. And I don't want these hospitals not to have this. So I do know now that any physician can make that make a determination. Thank you.
Representative Ward? Okay. Any other comments or questions on this? Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, just a comment. So with that information, A, does that make this amendment even necessary? And B, and I'm sorry if I'm speaking out of turn about it, but if there's a fix that this young lady has, then maybe we can come back and fix that at another time after we move the bill on to the general registry, and if we need to fix it after it passes or whatever. Is that something that seems like the right move?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Schoen. Yeah, Representative McNamara, am I saying your name right?
Close enough.
Close enough. Okay, thank you. I'm a little nervous about this because the bill before us is here because the consequences of this were not fully understood when the original bill was passed, and we're here fixing that today. And I'm just afraid that we may be doing the same thing again by making this oral amendment that really wasn't fully considered. So if it's okay with you, I think I will withdraw my motion to amend this, and that can be worked on. Perhaps we can always do an amendment for the floor if
yep.
there's further work done, and if it turns out, if people are kind of satisfied that it's a minor amendment, it could possibly be done on the floor, or it could possibly be an amendment to another bill. So I guess I would, if that's okay with you, I guess I would withdraw that, and we're in a bit of a time crunch today as well. So
Madam Chair, if I read you correctly, if the amendment is needed, we'll amend it on the floor.
Well, Representative McNamara, that's kind of up to you as the author, and yep. it's not up to me, but I certainly will work with you to help you.
I would be okay with that.
All right, thank you. So we're back to the bill as it stands. Members, any other conversation on this? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 582 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, testifiers.
Madam Chair.
Representative Blomer.
I apologize. When we were passing the minutes, I didn't have them in front of me, and I noticed I'm not listed on yesterday's minutes, so I'm just wondering if I can be added.
All right. We can do that, Representative Blomer, and we'll fix it at the next meeting. We'll do the formal part of that. Thank you. Usually what members notice is if their name is not there. Yes. Okay. Thank you. So, Welcome to the committee. We have House File 176, and I will move that House File 176 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And welcome to the committee, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to be back. I haven't been to your committee very much. Good to see you. Members, I have before you House File 176, and this is a bill that expands medical assistance dental coverages for adults with disabilities. And sometimes in law, we make some changes due to fiscal need, and sometimes we find out after those changes are made that the repercussions are not very good for the people that we serve. This is one of those instances. This bill was actually included in last year's Health and Human Service Finance bill, and it was in the conference committee until the very last moments, and as they were crunching their numbers, it ended up falling out. I was deeply disappointed, and Representative Abler, I know, tried very hard to keep it in, but it did not. So I'm back again this year hoping for inclusion in the omnibus bill and passage of that. We have many individuals in our communities that live in, ICFMR or institutions of, we don't even call them institutions anymore, but housing units, group homes, who have significant disabilities but also significant dental needs. We have a very unique kind of partnership in our community that we'll share with you in just a moment. This particular, the care that's provided in the homes is particularly good for the people that live in those homes. They're not having to get in a van and being driven to the Twin Cities for care, or used to be Bloomington, or Blooming Prairie, I'm sorry, but Blooming Prairie's closed, and we'll deal with that dental issue at a different time. But we came up with a unique solution in our community that worked very well until these laws were changed and the dental codes were disallowed. And so we're going to let the testifiers here tell that story. It's a story of one little instance in our community, but I think all of you have persons with disabilities in your community who will reap the benefits if we can put these codes back in. And so, Madam Chair, I think we'll just, if it's all right with you, we'll just let our testifiers tell their stories. It's a good story with a great outcome financially and for all of us, but even better, it's better dental care for those with disabilities in my community and all across the state if we could get this bill passed.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Michael Helgeson, the Chief Executive Officer of AppleTree Dental. AppleTree is a nonprofit critical access dental provider. Our hub and spoke delivery systems serve 29 counties and 5 regions in Minnesota. Since 1986, we've delivered almost 1 million dental visits. We've been nationally recognized for our services to group home residents and frail elders living in long-term care. This bill restores essential services for the disabled. Disabled adults are the most medically complex and behaviorally challenged adults enrolled in the medical assistance program. Unlike other adults, most of this targeted population group will depend on medical assistance for the rest of their lives. So ignoring dental problems now only increases their costs and the health consequences down the road. Disabled adults face the greatest barriers to care in our society and suffer grave consequences when infections in their mouths spread. So what are the essential services in this bill? First, house calls. Please refer to the handout that we've provided that has some photos and some more data regarding house calls. In a few minutes, you're going to hear testimony about how house calls make it possible to provide better care, produce better health outcomes, and reduce total health care costs, the triple aim that all of us are really looking to achieve in health care. In fact, at a cost of less than $25, the cost of a house call is just a fraction of the alternative costs of transporting patients to dental services at distant clinics. So I believe it's a no-brainer that this benefit actually saves money right now as well as down the line in lower long-term health care costs. The second benefit is behavior management. This reimburses a little extra treatment time so that disabled adults can have a successful dental visit Again, you can visit a dentist if you don't get the care, if you don't get an accurate diagnosis, if you don't get the cleaning, it's a failed visit. The third service is oral or IV sedation. The days of physical restraint to provide dental care are over. And without these services, the only covered option is a $10,000 to $20,000 hospitalization for dental care under general anesthesia. Oral or IV sedation are safer, more timely, and a much lower cost alternative than that unnecessary hospitalization. The fourth essential service is risk and evidence-based prevention. This is something we're all talking about both within oral health and in healthcare in general. It's not one size fits all. So I'd like everyone to just think for a moment. If a medically complex disabled adult who's unable to maintain their own daily care is not high risk for dental disease, then who is? The evidence is actually quite clear. Disabled adults need more frequent cleanings to maintain a healthy mouth. So in closing, these four services clearly meet the healthcare reform's triple aim goal, and they're simply essential for personal hygiene and dignity. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I would welcome any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Helgeson. We have also Cindy Ostrowski.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, and members of the committee. I'm Cindy Ostrowski. I'm the Executive Director of Hiawatha Homes in Rochester. Back in 2009 and 2010, at Hiawatha Homes, we had some significant challenges trying to find dental care for the people that we support. We definitely support local dental care and encourage individuals we support to go to their local dentist whenever possible. However, because of the unique needs, entire medical needs of the people we support, we were assisting people, 25 people out of the 97 people we support, to out-of-town dental visits. The cost of transportation was great for Hiawatha Homes and or for those individuals needing specialized transportation. In calling a transportation provider today, the cost of transporting one person to and from Faribault is $216 for specialized transportation. I would encourage you to support this bill and support those dollars to be used on service and service delivery rather than transportation. We started working with AppleTree Dental in hopes that some of the codes had stayed in legislative language, but they were taken out. And so we've been uniquely supporting people at Hiawatha Homes through grants, through charity, in-kind gifts, donations, but those are running out and our grants have expired. We really need to reinstate these services for people with disabilities. I would like to share a few unique needs of the people we support and that benefit from these services. Out of 97 people we support in Hiawatha residential services throughout our community and 22 different independent homes, 46 of those individuals are now currently benefiting for on-site dental services. And one child who had never had a dentist is actually receiving services from AppleTree Dental on-site. So out of those 47 people, 41 the people that we support need total physical assistance with their oral health care. Six individuals have limited physical assistance, but there are zero people that we support who use AppleTree Dental on-site services that can totally independently care for their teeth and brush their teeth. 11 people we support who use AppleTree Dental on-site services have specialized tube feedings that affect their overall oral health care. 39 of them have significant medical diagnosis and such as seizure disorders or osteoporosis that has impacted their overall health care. Since July of 2011, we have been able to support 21 clinic days at our Hiawatha Homes lower level office in a friendly, warm, familiar environment. Individuals can come with their staff, they can come with their mom, their dad, family members, and they are able to get their dental services right on site. We have several family members who have commented that the cleaning that Dr. Christian and her team has provided has been the best cleaning ever. We have staff people that have said that when other people can't support the individuals because of their significant medical needs or behavioral support needs, because of their expertise, AppleTree Dental staff, Dr. Christian and her team, are able to have the person open their mouth and clean their mouth and are able to stay for a full cleaning. We strongly support House File 176, and we ask you to support this bill so that these individuals, these 47 people, can continue to get on-site dental services in a very dignified, respectful manner that meets their unique needs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we have a couple of members with questions. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Dr. Helgeson would be the best to address this, since I know that you serve both people in nursing homes as well as people with disabilities. And I have actually been approached by someone who was concerned by some people in nursing homes who have similar issues in terms of behavior problems, needs for disability, but their eligibility for medical assistance is probably under the senior provisions rather than adult with disabilities. And so I'm wondering if the definition on 2.20 is broad enough to accommodate them as well, or is, and maybe this would be for our council as well, but I'm just wondering if we need another bill to deal with those people who have behavior problems and other issues who happen to be elderly but need the same sort of backup services.
Dr. Helgeson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is an issue that is being looked at by the Department of Human Services. I know there are some federal CMS requirements regarding being able to have focused services for different groups of adults, and those are being looked at. So I think my understanding is that the fiscal note options are being developed, and that depending on how narrow or how broad that circle is drawn, that's going to have an impact on how many individuals are covered.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I look forward to addressing that in the Finance Committee rather than us having to do a separate bill, but it's a similar issue.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think my question is kind of along the same line. Is there, and this is to the author, is there income and asset? I mean, they got to be eligible for medical assistance in other ways in order to qualify for this benefit also?
I believe, Madam Chair, that it's that once they qualify for MA, this
okay.
then comes into to being. We're not changing the qualifications at all to okay. participate. And Madam Chair, if I can also say, you know, I know Representative Liebling has visited Hiawatha Homes and has seen this particular unique pilot that's gone on in our community that kind of drove me to have the desire to change this legislation in the first place. But the quality of care that's being provided is phenomenal. The relaxed atmosphere and the fact that they can get clients through a full dental cleaning more often than would happen if you're driving someone to a foreign place where you're not comfortable has been wonderful. But I think just to also point out that no matter where persons that are severely disabled get their teeth cleaned, the last bullets in here are really key, the last points and the lines in our bill, because what's happened without the ability to do some of those behavioral management and oral IV techniques, patients sometimes will be driven long distances or you know, get in a chair and get only one or two or three teeth cleaned before their time is up, before their patience has worn out, before perhaps the dentist can finish the work, and they're only entitled to one visit a year, and so they may only have two or three teeth cleaned a year, and then they can't finish that cleaning. So we're trying to really address what's best for the client, and I think we would all agree that being able to get all your teeth cleaned, not three of them, would be beneficial, and to do it in a humane way, certainly.
Right. Thank you, Representative Norton. And I just want to make sure that people understand these are people who have significant challenges, physical and or intellectual challenges. So they're people who, for the most part, just can't sit in a dental chair and get regular dentistry. You know, it's hard for a lot of people who don't have disabilities to sit in a dental chair and open their mouth and hold still.
Amen.
And all of that. So this is a very challenging population. So is there anybody else who wants to testify for or against the bill? The lady in the back.
She would just step back.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Candy Hazen,
and thank you, members of the committee. I speak on behalf of the Minnesota Dental Hygienists Association in support of H.R. 176. This is very important, and we're very supportive of this bill. We know as hygienists that we see many patients three or four times a year who can't afford their dental care, and we also see people who are disabled and realize that this need is far greater, and we will help prevent save money overall for the state by being able to take care of these people on a more regular basis. Although we do support this addition, we do not support that this service must be in accordance with an appropriate individualized treatment plan formulated by a licensed dentist, which is in lines 2.27 and 2.28, because dental hygienists often do treatment plan for prophylaxis. We work under general supervision, and we are able to see patients first before a dentist sees them in the office, and so we feel as though by limiting in this way, we may actually deny access for some patients. So we are just suggesting that that you look to amend possibly this. So I'm not suggesting that at this moment, but just that you consider that language, because we're afraid that it actually will limit access.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'm sure Representative Norton would be happy to talk with you about that issue.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I certainly would, and we hadn't been approached ahead of time. This was a surprise when we came today. So.
All right. Thank you, Representative Norton. Other questions from members? Oh, I think Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to thank you, Representative Norton, and thank you, Dr. Helgeson. You know, when we first met here a number of years ago, I said to you, I haven't seen a dentist ever in my nursing home. That went on for over 25 years, and I see you there now, and we have a beautiful dental clinic. And the residents don't have to go out in the middle of the winter and get bundled up and drive all the way to Blooming Prairie. Unfortunately, Blooming Prairie had to shut down. That was where we did go. And I also have many state-operated homes where we have individuals who are multiple handicapped and need these services. And it's often, and from when we would have to send patients down to Blooming Prairie, we would have to send help, the nursing assistant or so, to go with them, and we don't have that kind of help in the nursing home to take them off of the floor. So I do appreciate what you've done, and this is a great service that you provided for many, many people in our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Fritz, and I certainly hope that we can find the funding when we go to the Finance Committee. So seeing no other questions, I will renew the motion that House File 176 be recommended to pass and go to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Norton, did you want to say something more?
Just thank you very much for having the bill heard today, and hopefully I have the support of the committee.
All right. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the
thank
bill
you very
is
much.
Passed. Thank you very much. Okay, next up is Representative Loeffler, House File 195. And members, we have 20 minutes left in this hearing. I just want to remind people we have 5 bills left, I believe. We do have this room reserved. Room 10. We're going to be returning at 7:30, room 10. Okay, I apologize for that we're coming back so late, but we're going to try to move through these bills, and hopefully they're going to be, I think the most controversial are probably done, I hope. So, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would like to move House File 195 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, and I do have an A1 amendment. It's okay. a technical amendment suggested by our House Research Council just to make the wording more appropriate.
Representative Loeffler moves that House File 195 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. And let's see. And you have the A1 amendment, and Representative Loeffler moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she would like to discuss it. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill, I think, corrects what we believe to be an oversight in existing law in that it allows licensed dietitians and licensed nutritionists to enter into a protocol with a licensed practitioner, typically a physician, so that they can administer or work with Legend drugs with specific patients. And if you look at the bill, right now, people who have this authority include nurses, physician's assistants, medical students or residents, pharmacists, and you do have in your packet a letter from the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, which unanimously recommended this legislation at its December meeting. And to give you a little bit more background, I think you're going to find this works really well with our visions of the medical home and using people practicing to the highest level of their license and with their using their specialized knowledge. But this actually helps us build, I think, the right care team. I have with me Ann Erickson with the Minnesota Academy of Nutrition and Dietitians, and I would love to have her testify to this.
Welcome to the committee.
Well, thanks so much. I'm Ann Erickson. I'm a member of the Minnesota Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, representing the 1,600 licensed dietitians and nutritionists in the state of Minnesota. And first of all, thank you for hearing the bill today. This bill, as Representative Loeffler indicated, it updates an existing licensure statute and that essentially clarifies that licensed dietitians and licensed nutritionists are included in the list of healthcare team members who can adhere to a practice guideline or a protocol as delegated by the physician. So, and ultimately, it may result in administration of a prescription drug as predefined, predetermined by the physician. So, this non-controversial bill is already supported by the Board of Pharmacy. We have a strong physician community support for it also. And it codifies a highly valued and long-established practice. Healthcare organizations really rely on protocol adherence as the foundation for coordinating care, for keeping patients safe, for best practice, best outcome, cost savings, efficiency, effectiveness, etc. So all the buzzwords around health reform. There are many conditions and treatment-specific protocols in existence in clinics, hospitals, long-term care, and home care. Along with other members of the healthcare team, licensed dietitians and licensed nutritionists are involved in protocol administration as authorized by a physician when there's a nutrition management aspect of that protocol. So an easy to understand example would be a diabetes care protocol where that licensed dietitian or licensed nutritionist works with the patient, the family members, to coordinate the meal plan with the insulin schedule. But there are many others, in addition to diabetes care, there's cystic fibrosis, TPN, total parenteral nutrition, tube feeding, dialysis, etc. Practice guidelines and protocols drive a collaborative, integrated response from the healthcare team, and that is why it's so essential for cost-effective, patient-centered care. Licensed dietitians and licensed nutritionists bring proven, high-quality, low-cost nutrition management skills. And passage of this bill will ensure that this well-established and valued collaboration is codified into statute and continues to benefit Minnesotans. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And that concludes my prepared remarks, and I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. So am I understanding that this is current practice? It's basically being codified.
Very much so. Correct.
All right. Thank you. Other questions from members? Okay. I'm not seeing from members. Okay. I'm not seeing any. Is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? I'm not seeing any, but I see a question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So am I led to believe that we would codify the ability of a nutritionist to prescribe drugs?
No.
Erickson.
No, that is completely within the jurisdiction of the physician. So that is, yeah, that's a deal breaker. So any of the drug reference within that protocol might, for example, a titration schedule for insulin has already been predefined by under protocol that would be administered by the physician.
Representative Albright.
So the supervision of the nutritionist is a board-certified physician, Madam Chair?
Maybe Ms. Erickson would be, that'd be better addressed to Ms. Erickson, I guess. Maybe you want to repeat the question. Or
please. Would then, I'm led to believe then the nutritionist is supervised by a physician?
Ms. Erickson.
The term I hear used frequently is working under the auspices of the physician direction. So a physician delegate.
Representative Albright.
So is it a physician or a physician delegate?
Oh, the physician delegates that protocol authority to the healthcare team.
Okay. Thank you, Madam.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Perhaps I can then just share a personal anecdote. I had a family member who was diagnosed as diabetic. The physician, you know, just kind of handed off a pamphlet. And that person was totally confused as to what that meant they could or couldn't eat or how to manage it and that sort of thing. And it's a nutritionist or a dietitian who really has the time and the expertise to help them. And they're doing it within a protocol that has been approved by that physician that guides that work with that particular patient. But it allows the physician to delegate more of the education function to someone whose expertise is in balancing out that nutrition with the prescription, you know, what foods interact differently, all those sorts of things that might influence the effectiveness of that prescription.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking through, I'm just trying to figure out, you refer to a legend drug. I guess I don't know what a legend drug is. And if you could help me with that, that would be great.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Thank you for asking that question. I'm sure others don't know, too. Ms. Erickson.
Thank you. Yes, I had to look it up myself. It's generally, we think of it as a prescription drug. So a drug that has to be prescribed by the physician.
Representative Zerwas.
Okay. Well, here's a follow-up. Would that include narcotics and controlled substance? And
Madam Chair, can I help?
Well, let all right, Representative Schoen.
So, not to jump on Mr. Chun here, Madam Chair, because I think he could probably answer this as well, but a legend drug is not something that's scheduled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in those in the controlled substances. So that much I can give you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Representative Schoen. Ms. Erickson, did you want to comment
you.
Further?
No, I appreciate that.
Okay, so the answer to his question was no. Okay, further question, Representative Albright.
So if my understanding then, when you said that they're under the care of a nutritionist who is receiving instructions from a physician who delegates the responsibility for administration of the drug protocol for a legend drug, so my question then is, where does the liability lie if the protocol is not followed correctly? Is it the physician or is it the physician delegate?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, if you look at the bill, you'll see that this is the common practice for all kinds of licensed professionals in lines in Section 2, and perhaps Mr. Chun could address that. It's not a unique situation to this particular profession. This is adding them into the authority that's already existed in law for a large variety of licensed practitioners. So this wouldn't change it in terms of how it applies to all these licensed practitioners who can operate under the direction and protocol of a physician. And so it's still a legitimate question, but it would not change the situation as it applies to all these other professionals. It just adds
this group into that same definition. And with that, I would defer to Mr. Chun if he wanted to. But this bill doesn't try to change that in any way.
Mr. Chun?
Madam Chair, Mr. Loeffler, I'm not exactly sure how the liability works on this. I think that there's going to be some measure of either liability or responsibility to the delegating, you know, healthcare professional. But I'm not sure. I don't know if Ms. Aves is, you know, more familiar with that.
Ms. Aves? Madam Chair and members, I assume that the delegating physician bears some liability, but I am not real sure about how that liability would be divided between the delegating physician and the person that is following the direction of the physician. I can check and let you know.
Yeah, Representative Albright, I think Representative Loeffler's point, in terms of this bill, there was sort of an oversight that this group was left out, and that's why I started by saying earlier that this is something that's kind of practiced, and the reason that it's practiced is because it's in law, and many other professions are operating this way under these protocols. This is a pretty common thing right now, and in statute, the dietitians were left out of that when, in fact, they have an important role to do this kind of coordination with physicians. Am I correct, Ms. Erickson?
That is correct. And in fact, the last time the physician statute or the pharmacist statute was opened two or three years ago, it was to add pharmacist to their own statute. So this would not be the first time that a healthcare professional member has been added.
Right. Representative Albright.
Yeah, just I haven't memorized all the statutes yet, so I'm just going about the process of making sure that we as a state and representatives of the state are being good stewards of risk management, so I'll leave it at that.
Representative Albright, your questions are very appropriate, and I appreciate them, and there is a huge learning curve here, and we're all on it, so no apology needed at all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions, members? Okay, any other testifiers? All right, so seeing none, Representative Loeffler is going to renew her motion that House File 195 be recommended to pass as amended and placed on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails and the bill is passed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In the last 5 minutes, we've got House File 215, Representative Ward. All right, Representative Ward, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 215. Madam Chair and members, I thank you for listening to this bill.
And let me just one second.
I'm Joanne Ward.
So Representative Ward is moving that House File 215 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Okay. Go ahead, Representative Ward.
Thank you. I'm Joanne Ward, and I want to thank you for your attention. This is a non-controversial legislation to change the word physician to licensed healthcare professional. We can explain this a little bit more. I have a personal interest and appreciation for what these people do. I had a long history of back issues and had a back injury in 2000 and ended up with back surgery, but 4 years of occupational and physical therapy to get me to the point where I could function in life and not be confined to a wheelchair, which was what was projected. So I want to introduce Karen Sames to you, who will explain a little bit more about this.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Karen Sames. I'm representing the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association, and I'm here to urge your approval of House File 215, which modifies our licensure statutes. Physical agent modalities are things like heat and ice and ultrasound and electrical stimulation that are used to prepare clients for participation in meaningful occupations, the daily life skills that people use. not all occupational therapists use physical agent modalities, or our slang is PAMS. Those that do need additional certification through the Minnesota Department of Health. Under our current licensure statutes, the only part of our practice that requires a physician order is the use of PAMS. And we understand that that's limiting in some respects and slowing down access to services because many physicians, for example, orthopedists, work hand-in-hand with physician assistants, and the physician assistants often provide the follow-up care. And if a physician assistant is seeing a client and wants to refer that person for physical agent modalities through an occupational therapist, say for a hand injury, they might write out that prescription and have the patient carry that to their occupational therapy session on that first day of therapy, and the occupational therapist right now cannot act on that order if it's written by a physician assistant. The occupational therapist would have to get in touch with the physician and it would delay care. So we simply want to change the word physician to licensed healthcare professional, which would include physicians, physician assistants, nurse, advanced practice nurses or nurse practitioners, chiropractors, podiatrists, and optometrists. And that definition of licensed healthcare professional already exists in our licensure statute. It's not controversial. We've talked with the Minnesota Medical Association, the Physician Assistant Association, the Physical Therapy Association, the Podiatry, Chiropractic Association. Everybody's okay with this bill, so we urge your support. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there questions?
No.
Not seeing any. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? And I'm not seeing anybody, so Representative Ward is going to renew her motion that House File 215 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Ward. And we are going
Thank
to stand
you.
In recess until 7:30 in room 10, okay? 7:30 in room 10. Thank you.
We'd like to call the committee to order, please. Representative Morgan, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 607 to be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Thank you. So Representative Morgan moves that House File 607 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Madam Chair, I also have an author's amendment I'd like to offer.
Okay. Would you like to do
I
that?
I will offer the A1 amendment, Madam Chair. It clarifies an issue to help meet the needs or the concerns of another stakeholder group.
Okay. Oh. Okay. So Representative Morgan moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? So moved.
No nays.
So moved. It's just late in the evening, but we're going to do this.
Excellent work. You squeaked one by us again.
You got one vote.
Okay. So the amendment is adopted. Representative Morgan, would you go ahead, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just say that it's a good thing the author's on the committee this time. Madam Chair, this simple bill updates Minnesota law to reflect what optometrists currently perform in their scope of practice and allows them to receive appropriate reimbursements. The bill is similar to legislation which was offered 2 years ago here in the House by Representative Barrett and others. This time, key stakeholders have gotten together. The amendment that was offered, as I said, helped clear up some of the concerns mentioned by other stakeholder groups. Currently, the groups include the Minnesota Optometrics Association, and Dr. Jonathan Shorn is here from that group right now, the Minnesota Academy of Ophthalmology, the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association, and the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I haven't heard from any other stakeholder groups, but all of those groups now support the bill with the amendment added. So with that, I will introduce Dr. Jonathan Shorn, president of the Minnesota Optometrics Association, to talk more about the bill. Dr. Shorn,
please.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the time to speak to you today. I'm an optometrist. I work in Lakeville, live in Invergrove Heights, and I'm representing the Minnesota Optometric Association today. Basically, optometrists work throughout the state. We are distributed in nearly every county. We deal with primary eye care. We're dealing with people who come in, of course, for the need for glasses, contact lenses. We're also trying to, on a daily basis, we're dealing with individuals who have pink eye. We're taking foreign bodies out of people's eyes. We're dealing with people who have glaucoma and treating them for that. Some of our optometrists in the state are treating children who are struggling in school to learn because their brain is not processing the information that their eyes are giving them. We deal with individuals who have gone through a traumatic brain injury and who are trying to become ambulatory once again, and their eyes need to coordinate with their brain in order to do that. And so what happened is several of our members were getting rejections from third-party payers for procedures that we are currently doing under our scope of practice, primarily because the third-party payers were saying that the visual system, which includes the brain processing of the information that the eyes give them, that was not in our language. And so we basically brought this forward in order to get the term visual system into the definition of what we do. And you'll also see language in there about rehabilitative therapeutic vision care. And again, like Representative here said, that we've met with all of our stakeholders, and we believe that there's peace in the valley, and it would be and so not to take up any more of your time, we would just request that the committee pass this bill on to the general register. I'd like it to be also known that I testified this morning in the Senate Health and Human Services Policy Committee, where we passed the companion bill out of that committee onto the general register as well. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Anyone have any questions? Anyone in the audience have any questions for any testimonies for or against? Okay. Seeing none, let's renew the motion. Representative Morgan renews his motion that Health File 607 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register as amended. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill passed.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you. Okay. So, Representative Loeffler, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am honored to make a motion to pass House File 213, and recommend that it be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you.
And this bill deals with a really exciting pilot project that we authorized in Hennepin County called Hennepin Health. In your packet, there's some background material on it. We'll have another bill that will give you a chance to hear even more about its successes. But this bill before you deals with the co-payments and expectations of a very difficult-to-serve population. They actually specialize in serving some of our hardest to serve and most expensive MA clients in terms of their the instability of their lifestyle. And with that, I would like to invite some of the experts on this from Hennepin County to testify and tell you more.
Okay, who will be testifying?
Great.
You come up, please. So good evening, and thank you for being here. Can you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, good evening, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Ross Owen, and I'm the product manager for the Hennepin County Demonstration Project, Hennepin Health. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you tonight, and I'm going to give a few introductory remarks about Hennepin Health and the work that we're engaged in before handing it off to my colleagues, who will give some more detail about the impact of the cost-sharing requirements on the members that we serve in the program. As Representative Loeffler stated, Hennepin Health is an accountable care demonstration which serves roughly 6,000 Medicaid enrollees in Hennepin County who are part of the Medicaid early expansion option. And the structure of the project is quite unique in that a number of different entities under the umbrella of Hennepin County have jointly gotten together to contract with the Minnesota Department of Human Services to serve this population on a prospective total cost of care basis. And so the program has really been about working together to provide better integrated care, better coordinated services amongst those different organizations, all of whom really play an integral part in touching and providing services to this member population. We are in the beginning of the second year of our existence in Hennepin Health, so quite young, and a lot of work ahead of us, as well as a lot of some good early successes behind us. The overall goal, as I said, of Hennepin Health is really about better integrating healthcare services with social services and working together in new ways across silos so that we can reduce costs and improve the quality of care. A couple of unique features of Hennepin Health that I'd like to highlight a little bit further. One is the unique population served. Even within the universe of Medicaid recipients in Hennepin County, this is a very challenging population. We are the only managed care program or product focused exclusively on serving this Medicaid early expansion population. And so these are all individuals without adults without children who earn less than 75% of the federal poverty level, which is roughly $677 a month to meet all of their expenses. And these are individuals, as you can imagine, who have often historically lacked strong links to the healthcare system and relationships with a healthcare provider that persists over time. So to give you a quick snapshot of some of the most pervasive issues faced by the population, our current Hennepin Health membership, roughly 45% of them, so nearly half, have some level of chemical dependency. 42% have a mental health diagnosis. And roughly one-third of them have unstable housing or are precariously housed. And these are often co-occurring at the same time for the same person. So as you can imagine, a population that's a little difficult to get our arms around and engage, but at which we've been focused very closely. So in addition to the unique population served, that challenging subset of Medicaid recipients, another really distinguishing feature that has made this program distinctive is the financial structure and the financial incentives that it creates. As I said, Hennepin Health is paid on an upfront total cost of care basis to cover all of the covered services that members get. And so this has created some new dynamics between the partners that have really created some powerful efficiencies. So really our work of trying to end a cycle of crisis-driven, very chaotic care focused in the emergency department as the access point, frequent hospital admissions, to really replace that with an ongoing relationship with a team based in a primary care clinic has been our focus. And with Hennepin Health, the financial incentives now make ending that cycle and building the primary care relationship the right thing to do financially as well as the right thing to do clinically. The bill that's before you would exempt the individuals participating in the Hennepin Health demonstration from copayment requirements in statute. And my colleagues here today are going to do a much better job than I would of explaining to you why we think this is good policy and is really an administrative burden on the program without a lot of return. I think that the main themes in our comments are going to be about the impact of that administrative burden both on Hennepin Health as a managed care organization but also on the providers that make up the partnership who are often on the front lines of having the responsibility to collect these co-payments. And my colleagues will tell you about what that administrative burden entails for their organizations. But this is really a disproportionate impact on Hennepin Health because, in fact, a vast majority of our members, over 80%, are exempt from these requirements in the end because of the caps that are in statute as well. And so all of the efforts that are required to collect the money ultimately for a very small population who's even subject to the requirement. So it's a disproportionate impact on us due to the population served. And secondly, in addition to the administrative burden, is really the challenge and the potential barrier that's put in place when we're taking a population and trying to establish that relationship, get folks to adhere to a medication regimen, to show up at regularly scheduled office visits, and even the perception of a cost-sharing requirement for folks at this income level can really create a barrier that makes it less likely that we'll be successful in establishing those relationships. And so with that, I'd like to pass to my colleague Kieran Sturm for some additional comments.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes. My name is Kieran Sturm. I'm the acting CEO at Metropolitan Health Plan. Thank you, Madam Chair, and representatives, for this opportunity to speak before you this evening on a very important issue that impacts the care of our members, the Hennepin Health members, that are a very vulnerable population within Hennepin County. MHP serves approximately 10,000 Medicaid and Medicare members. 6,000 of those members are Hennepin Health members who have an income, as was stated, 75% of the federal poverty level. Many of those members have multiple issues that they deal with, chronic illnesses, chemical dependency, and mental health needs that require frequent visits to the physician, as well as many medications. Because of the low income of this population, paying for a copay for an office visit and medications just isn't a priority for them with the limited dollars that they have available. This leads to non-compliance, resulting in exacerbations of their illnesses, repeat hospitalizations, and ER visits. Just as a review, their copays include $3 for prescriptions, brand name prescriptions, $1 for generic drugs, $3 for non-preventative visits, $3.50 for non-emergency visits to the emergency room. Mental health visits are exempt, as well as antipsychotic drugs. Currently, about 80 to 90% of the Hennepin Health members, based on the timing, have a copay cap. 90% of those, of the 90% that have the copay cap, about 98% of those paid nothing for copayment because their income is so low. Administratively, it is very difficult to track the monthly cost sharing that is required of health plans. The timeliness of a claim that is not aligned with the monthly tracking of the cost sharing. For example, let me give you an example. The member sees a provider on January 1st, but the claim is not submitted until March 1st. The monthly cap cannot be calculated based on the delay in the claim. The MCO also must ensure that no provider denies covered services to an enrollee because of the enrollee's inability to pay the cost sharing. This is impossible because we are not at the point of service. Upon the enrollee's assertion that he or she is unable to pay the cost sharing, the health plan also must ensure that providers not deny service, give enrollees advance notice of the provider's debt policy, and allow enrollees reasonable opportunity to make a payment. This also is very administratively burdensome, as well as unable at times to track. Health plans are required to track and submit annual statutory financial filings related to the value of their cost sharing. The administrative burden of tracking this data, preparing and submitting the report, far outweighs the financial benefit of the cost-sharing requirement. Health plans are not allowed to contract to build or hold employees responsible in any way for charges of cost-sharing for medically necessary services. Even if billing was possible for a health plan, we have an issue in finding our members. The mailings that we do send out, approximately 50 to 60% of those mailings are returned. Our request this evening is to remove the cost-sharing requirement for Hennepin Health members, not only because of the administrative burden to the health plan, but also as a barrier that cost-sharing creates for the member to maintain their health. We've structured the bill in such a way as to avoid a fiscal note. We anticipate that this change would be a budget neutral and not require any additional funding.
Thank you. And let's testify. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Bergs. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at North Point Health and Wellness Center, which is a federally qualified health center in North Minneapolis, serving about 22,000 residents of that area. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening. North Point, we see about 86,000 patient visits in our medical, dental, and behavioral health centers every year, and a number of those patients are Hennepin Health patients. I think I won't go over the same ground that my colleagues have already gone over. They've said it very well. But from just to tell a little bit more about from a provider point of view, this is administratively burdensome in that it's very confusing for our administrative staff, our registration staff, to determine which visits are truly subject to the copay and which ones are not. As a federally qualified healthcare center, North Point is required to make a good faith effort to collect every dollar that's available to the center. And so we are required to ask patients for those copays. With the administrative burden that we don't always understand exactly what those are, the patients have an even more difficult time figuring out which visits are subject to the copay. It does inhibit some of the care for our patients. Whether or not the $3 is truly stopping a great number of patients from making appointments, I don't have any data for that. What I can tell you is that anecdotally, I've had a number of providers in my office asking to remove the $3 copay because what they find is when they meet with patients, that becomes a very large subject for these patients. They want to say, gee, we can't keep coming in. We can't afford this $3. And it takes up a lot of the time that the providers have with the patients. And it's an excuse for patients to say, we're not coming in, whether real or not real. It's an excuse that they make, and it does inhibit their care, as Ms. Sturm has testified. So given the reason that it does inhibit care, and we are trying to do something different with Hennepin Health, trying a different model, trying to find a way to do more cost savings for health care and provide better care, increasing the health outcomes for our patients. Because of that, and because of the administrative burden that it does place on health centers, we are requesting to remove the copays for Hennepin Health patients.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Adler.
Thank you. It's a novel idea to have a health plan coming saying, we'd like to have less money. So we're all for that. But actually, I know the topic pretty well. And this is the old GAMC population, people under 75% of poverty, $8,000 a year or less, a lot of chronic, very interesting mobility concerns and all, and part of the reason you have a copay in the first place is so people that tend to overutilize care might not at least have some skin in the game. In this population, you want them to go for any reason at all, so they might come once in a while. It was discovered, I know, when you did your, was it level 3 services under the old GAMC, the Coordinated Care Delivery System, that when people who would be tending to go more often for reasons when they were tended to in a different way that they actually had tremendously better outcomes and you saved about almost 30% of the money. So as novel as this may be, I just want to explain to my understanding this is actually going to facilitate and the paperwork to collect to try to figure out $1 or $3 that the people can actually refuse to pay and they still get to come. And so it's if you're a $4,000 a year person, the $3 does add up. So I think it's a good idea and I'm happy to be a co-author. So. And good luck. Thank you for your services there. You've done a lot of good work in this population. So, thanks.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions, the first of which is obviously you're supporting a contingency that would be served under MA, and MA is changing in light of the health insurance exchange. What coordination would this, or what effect would this change have on the folks that would be served under MA and insurance exchange in the state of Minnesota?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and
Representative Blaufler.
I'd be glad to take a stab at that.
The exchange will be the eligibility entry point for people on medical assistance under the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. And so these individuals will be enrolled through the exchange, just like anyone else on MA. Because they're in this unique pilot project, you know, I assume that that will be one of the selections that they have to provide continuity. But if anyone else has more details here, I'd be glad to have you share it. But that's my understanding, is that's the main touch point. These are pilot projects offered separately, and so I think they would be coded and going into this pilot. Because the purpose of this is to test a new delivery system with a group that has been very expensive and see if we can do a better job of integrating acute care and social services to stabilize their lives and reduce, ultimately, their drain on the system in a variety of ways. And it's expected to be a multi-year project in which we're already getting good data.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final question. In the handout from Hennepin Health on this, under core elements, under the last bullet point, you describe an integrated data warehouse. And in light of current discussions about patient protection, data privacy, if you could just describe for me what protections and or what that data warehouse looks like.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Owens.
Representative Albright, the data warehouse referred to in the document is a way that the partner organizations, including the provider entities, Hennepin County Medical Center and North Point Health and Wellness Center, are combining their data and sharing it with the financial data, the claims data collected by Metropolitan Health Plan. And so under HIPAA protections and through a business associate agreement between the partner organizations within the county, the data warehouse is really intended to provide some efficiencies rather than pulling information from multiple systems from an information technology perspective. This places that information in a single data repository, making it more accessible. The individuals who are able to access that data are the same individuals who would be if it were remaining in its component systems.
Okay. Representative Albright?
I guess I'd just like to maybe have you elaborate just from a personal protections in terms of the disclaimer and or the information provided to the patient in terms of what they're afforded to understand about the collaboration between the entities. Obviously, there's a movement of that data going between a number of points. We just want to make sure that they're informed of and consent across multiple channels.
Mr.
Representative Albright, so the healthcare data contained in the data warehouse is protected by HIPAA, and so the patient consents are gathered both when individuals become eligible for medical assistance and by the provider organizations at the point of care. In the rare cases where the data that's integrated into the warehouse extend into the social service realm, Hennepin Health has actually developed an additional consent that covers those data elements that are outside of HIPAA. And so individuals receive that separate consent form and have a conversation and have the opportunity to choose to sign it or to opt out, and only in those cases are the extra outside of HIPAA data shared amongst those providers.
Mm-hmm. Representative Albright.
Just an observation for the chair, but from the standpoint of that, is there any consideration, maybe the CA might discuss this, would this be beneficial, or is this a bill going to civil law for Data Practices Act?
Well, currently it's going to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, the bill itself only deals with the issue of the cost sharing and waiving under our Medicaid rules. It doesn't deal with the setup of the project itself, which was already enacted into law in a previous session. So for this particular bill, I don't think there's anything in it that deals at all with the issues you're raising. Those were more involved in the setting up and authorizing of this pilot project, if that's helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler and guests, I appreciate your coming, and I'm excited about this program, and I'm excited for you to be able to work in it. I'm sure that you're seeing results already. But I don't, and skimming through, I may have missed this, but there's references to social service connections, but particularly with the mental health issues. Is there, what kind of tracking are you doing on this, and how do you manage the network for the social services that these people need? Because they're diverse in some cases.
Madam Chair,
Representative Loeffler.
Representative Ward, we'll be glad to answer that, but I should let you know that there's another bill coming that will go to this committee that will give us an opportunity to, in more detail, talk about the project. And so some of those things, we'll have a different panel of experts that can go through in more detail some of these things. But if you'd like to answer that question briefly, we could certainly do that.
Ms. Frum?
We are very fortunate within Hennepin Health because we have four core partners. We have North Point, we have HCMC, MHP, and then HSPHD, which is our human services social side of the business within Hennepin Health. So we make referrals within that system for mental health care, as well as we also have contracts with external providers, community providers. So we have a good circle of available services available for these individuals. And we do track that information through HSPHD, the Social Services Division, as well as through claims and other data that we receive.
Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one other thing that I didn't see in here, and I appreciate, I'm looking forward to hearing more in the next bill. How are ambulance services handled with these patients?
Ms. Strom.
Ambulance services is a covered benefit for these individuals, as well as bus passes to get to their clinic appointments, mental health appointments, and other social services, housing.
Representative Ward?
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Anyone else wish to testify in the audience? Okay. So we're going to renew the motion. Representative Loeffler renews her motion that Health File 213 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. The bill is passed and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you. So, the next bill we have up for consideration is House 5672. Representative Liebling, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would move House File 672. And where is it going?
It's going to Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
Okay. So I move that House File 672 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you. So Representative Liebling moves that House File 672 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Liebling, please go ahead and introduce your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for sticking around late to hear this, and apologize to my testifiers, making them stick around late as well. But this is a very simple but very important bill that is designed to improve stroke care for patients around the state. And I'm not going to say a lot about it. I'm going to let the testifiers explain it. But I do want to say that these are the kinds of initiatives that really make Minnesota a really great state in terms of our health care. These ideas, I believe, are coming from the provider community, and we're going to hear about how this pretty simple idea has the potential to save a lot of lives and also to save a lot of disability in the state, and therefore also a lot of cost. So go ahead.
Well, welcome to the committee. Can you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Good evening. My name is Dr. Albert Tsai, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Stroke Registry Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you for the opportunity to explain this stroke system that about which this bill is about. Stroke is the third leading cause of death in Minnesota and a leading cause of disability. Every year, hospitalizations for stroke cost over $380 million. The bottom line is that stroke is a major medical and public health problem. But fortunately, in just the past 10 to 15 years, we've been able to offer more and more treatment options, so long as patients can get to a hospital that is ready to provide these treatments. And this is the underlying premise of having an organized, coordinated stroke system. Stroke is a time-critical medical event, which means that if a person can get treatment quickly, the chances for a positive health outcome are quite good in most cases. So hospitals which are certified by the Joint Commission as primary stroke centers have demonstrated through that they have the capacity to and the expertise to treat acute stroke patients. And these hospitals have undergone a rigorous process to meet very high standards. And in Minnesota, we have 16 certified primary stroke centers. However, nearly one quarter of the state's population lives over an hour away from a primary stroke center, which is over a million people. And moreover, in these areas that are far away from a primary stroke center, the population is generally older, a population that's at higher risk for stroke. And at the same time, we know that around one in three patients, stroke patients, over 3,000 a year, go first to a hospital in rural Minnesota. Now, we know that many of our critical access hospitals provide very high quality care. Yet the main point of having a system is to ensure that all hospitals, large and small, regardless of where they are in the state, are prepared to diagnose and treat stroke patients. So in other words, if you are in a rural part of the state and have a stroke, you should be assured that you'll get the best care possible at the hospital in your community. So in a statewide stroke system, paramedics and EMTs use protocols to screen stroke patients and direct them to hospitals prepared to treat them. They pre-notify the hospital so the hospital can be ready to receive the patient, and all hospitals are ready to diagnose and treat stroke patients as soon as they arrive in the emergency department. So the primary focus of the system, therefore, is getting all stroke patients to a stroke-ready hospital as quickly as possible for that initial diagnosis and treatment. So this bill is important because the first step in this whole process that I've described is to formally set care standards for hospitals to reach, to officially recognize hospitals for providing high-quality stroke care. And once this is in place, we can then implement other parts of the system. EMS protocols that are locally developed can include guidance for taking suspected stroke patients to hospitals which are now recognized by the state. And hospitals and EMS can engage in performance improvement to ensure that and maintain their high quality of care. And then we'll also be able to better identify hospitals that need assistance in building the capacity to provide this high-quality care. This systems approach has been implemented in all 50 states using slightly different models. And here in Minnesota, in partnership with the American Heart Association, we convened a council of healthcare professionals, stroke experts, and other stakeholders to develop a framework for a statewide stroke system. This group met for nearly 2 years in monthly meetings to discuss and debate and create a system plan. Over 100 people representing over 50 hospitals, EMS agencies, health plans, and other groups participated in these meetings. We developed criteria for hospitals, a model EMS stroke protocol, and in general, a framework for the system. And in addition, we presented this concept and our entire planning process to EMS medical directors, hospitals, rural health organizations, emergency physicians, and other groups, and quite frankly, anyone who wanted to listen to get feedback and input and ideas. So this bill specifically does two things. One, recognizes if you're a certified comprehensive or primary stroke center recognized by the Joint Commission or a national body, that the state will recognize that designation. And then two, if a hospital meets the criteria outlined in the bill, that we designate those hospitals as acute stroke ready hospitals. This provides the groundwork and the framework for the system. Once we have this in place, we'll review those applications and designate those hospitals. And then the next phases will entail working with EMS agencies so that they can adopt protocols that will ensure that stroke patients are not only screened properly, but they're transported as quickly as possible to these designated hospitals. And then throughout this entire process, we're committed to providing educational opportunities all around the state to help hospitals get up to speed with the latest in stroke care. We do not anticipate these later phases to require more legislation. To sum up, our long-term vision is to address all aspects of the continuum of care from prevention all the way to rehabilitation. Our initial goal, however, is to make sure that every hospital in the state is able to provide fast and accurate diagnosis and treatment for stroke patients. And we're very pleased to say that we've gotten support from many stakeholder groups all across the state. Thank you for your time and for the opportunity to describe the stroke system, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have after our next testifier.
Thank you. To our next testifier, could you please introduce yourself?
Hi. Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Donna Lindsay. I'm a registered nurse, and for over 25 years, I've been working in the care of stroke patients, both as a nurse at the bedside and for many years now helping to facilitate stroke programs in several different hospitals. One of my more recent endeavors was to become primary stroke center certified, where I was working, and then take the program that we built in a metropolitan hospital and take our stroke expertise out to the rural communities and help them in providing care in their own communities where they lacked stroke specialists. We set up systems that allowed our neurologists to provide them with consultation and help them in identifying appropriate patients for emergency treatment. And what we found through this process is that essentially any hospital is capable of providing emergency treatment for stroke if you give them the right tools, and it doesn't cost anything to do that. You just have to create those linkages. And that's one of the components of this bill that I think is going to be such a phenomenal asset to the capability of all hospitals to provide appropriate care to stroke, is that we will designate for the EMS system where they can safely take patients and know that those services are available, and then we can promote linkages to the primary and comprehensive stroke centers where advanced treatment is available if appropriate or needed, and the expertise in those centers can be shared with the rural hospitals if needed. You know, I have a whole prepared statement written here, but a lot of it is redundant of what Dr. Tsai has already presented. And so what I really just want to share with you is that I have seen this model work on a small scale, and I have seen a small hospital that provided emergency treatment in the form of the IV therapy that's available in the first 4.5 hours after stroke. This hospital had provided that care to one patient in the past 3 years, and after we rolled out a program, educated their staff, and made our experts available to them, they were treating more patients on a monthly basis than we were in a metropolitan hospital that saw 10 times the number of patients in our emergency department. And it was to do with the age of their population that they were serving. They were seeing a lot of strokes, and so they went from treating virtually no one to treating almost everyone. So I've seen this be successful, and I am very passionate about this. I've participated in the Stroke Council and the development of this work, and I would just like to thank you for the opportunity to present this bill, and I would love to ask for your support on House File 672. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Tsai, and to the witnesses, I was glad to hear that this is integrated with the EMS system, because I'd carried a bill for the Department of Health some years ago that made sure that ambulances could quickly take people to the most appropriate hospital, even if that meant passing by one that just wasn't as ready to handle a serious situation as maybe the next one that was close by. And it sounds like you're integrating that into the transition here, but I love your goal that everybody should be better prepared to deal with this. I did have a question, though, because the bill provides different levels of stroke centers. You know, we have the comprehensive, the primary, the acute stroke ready hospital. I assume, but I'd love to hear you explain, that is not just about the initial treatment, but maybe about their support systems afterwards. And if there's still going to remain those distinctions in terms of the different titles, it appears to me that in line 2.17, that any of these hospitals, no matter where they're at on that continuum, could use the stroke center or stroke hospital designation, and I'm wondering if that's a little confusing to the public. So I'm just trying to better understand, what is the tiering, what does that represent, and are we taking away that distinction in terms of the public's understanding, you know, the real capabilities of that particular health center?
Who would like to answer that? Dr. Tsai?
Sure, I'll take a stab at it. Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. The distinctions between the three types of hospitals is such that comprehensive stroke centers take typically the advanced or the most complex cases that need secondary care. Is that what you say? Not secondary care, but more advanced care. Primary stroke centers have some of those capabilities, but maybe not as much as a comprehensive stroke center. And an acute stroke ready hospital, what we're talking about here is really the initial phase, what we call the hyperacute phase, where the diagnosis and treatment, typically of IV thrombolytic therapy, is what's in order. And then thereafter, the decision is made to transfer that patient to either a primary or a comprehensive stroke center. So as far as distinctions go, it really has more to do with care after the initial phase of treatment goes. But you're right. All three of these hospitals we would consider acute stroke ready for this initial phase. Does that answer your question?
Madam Chair,
Representative Law,
and Dr. Tsai, well, I think it sounds like there still remain some important distinctions. And so I don't understand why we would have Section 3 that tries to get rid of those. I think you can still achieve the goal of having everyone stroke ready and able to, you know, meet that level of care without having to create a new naming system and statute that allows all of those three distinctions to be blurred into a common stroke center or stroke hospital. When there are still remaining some distinctions in terms of between those levels of care. And so I'm just trying to understand why it's important to have the naming distinction in Section 3 when they will still have these different levels of designation in Section 2 that are conveyed by outside groups or by, you know, some standards in the industry.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Loeffler, I'm not sure if I'm totally understanding your concern, but this is kind of what I'm seeing, and maybe if my testifiers hear me say this wrong, they can correct me. But as I'm understanding this, you already have these two designations that are already, that the accrediting agencies already recognize these two designations as comprehensive stroke center or primary. They're really adding another one, which is the acute stroke ready hospital, which is the lowest level, I guess, is the way to put it. But they're bringing people up to a level that they're not currently at, and that's going to be sort of the basic level, if I'm maybe not misstating it. But then the naming, as I'm understanding Section 3, what they're saying is now for any hospital to use the word stroke center, stroke hospital in its name at all means that it has to be under this designation system as one of those three things. So this is an attempt to sort of give hospitals a little advertising, I guess, or a little, you know, reason to sort of reach one of these three levels, and as I'm just understanding the language, the subdivision one is just trying to say that unless you're one of these three, you don't get to use that terminology. Is that kind of what you're doing here?
Thank you,
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, and Representative Lee, I get that. I just don't understand why we wouldn't just have them authorized to use the names that are in Section 2. So if you meet the standards of being an acute stroke-ready hospital, you get to advertise yourself as a stroke-ready hospital. If you meet the standards for primary stroke center, you get to call yourself a primary stroke center. And if you're at the, you know, you take the most difficult and you have the most comprehensive neurology department, you get to be a comprehensive stroke center. And my sense is that by adding the new titles on line 2.17, you create some new designations that are more confusing in terms of a stroke center, a stroke hospital. I think you could, in Section 2, say no one can use these titles without being certified by the Department of Health or JCO at these levels. But I think you're introducing some new titles is what I was concerned about that might be used in advertising, like stroke center, stroke hospital, rather than using the distinction of stroke-ready hospital, primary stroke center, comprehensive stroke center. And that was where I thought those three distinctions were useful, and reserving those three to the people who've met the standards for those three I think is appropriate. I was just confused by why we're adding two more titles potentially. And because I could see a hospital that was an acute stroke-ready hospital based on line 2.17 advertising themselves as a stroke hospital, and it doesn't designate what level they are.
Representative,
that was my point, if that helps.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, I'm still struggling a little bit to see where you're really reading that in the bill, because what I'm reading on 2.17 is saying no hospital shall use these terms. So it's kind of trying to get rid of anybody else who might confuse the field by throwing these terms in there in some form. You know, Woodland Hills Stroke Hospital, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm just making up a name, and without it meaning anything. And so I guess...
Okay, Madam Chair, I think I understand how we're not communicating, okay? It says... On line 2.15, unless it has been designated a stroke hospital by these three different groups, it can't use those titles. But I would actually move that up to subdivision 2 or section 2 and say unless it has been designated by these, it can't use the following titles and use those three so that we have three very clear titles and... that we don't have an acute stroke-ready hospital calling themselves a stroke hospital, just those two words, and not knowing where that fits within the continuum.
Dr. Tsai, would you like to weigh in on it?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think I understand your concern there. Hopefully I'm not repeating the sort of communication gap here, but I think the main reason for this section here was to distinguish between those that are not designated at all versus those that uh-huh. that are, and I guess I don't see that there was any real true likelihood that there's going to be mistaken labeling by hospitals in this regard between acute stroke ready hospitals and primary stroke centers or comprehensive stroke centers in this term stroke hospital. It's my opinion that it's probably not that big a an important distinction to make for that acute phase of treatment if someone calls themselves a stroke hospital, and that I think that's what's the most important distinction here is between those that are designated and those that are not.
So why don't I suggest that maybe the three of you or four can work on this before we get to the next committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Liebman.
Madam Chair, I think I know what the problem is, and I think we could fix it real pretty easily now that I understand what it is, and maybe Ms. Cleveland can help me here, because I think if we just took the language on line 2.15 where it says a stroke hospital and put in something that says replace those words with unless it has been designated under one of the designations set forth in subdivision 2, instead of those three words, instead of a stroke hospital. Ms. Cleveland, do you see what I'm trying to do here? So to explicitly refer it to subdivision 2 designations.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I think that would work. It doesn't tie it back then to the three separate titles in what would be section 2 of the bill. But I don't know if that matters or not.
Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess I'm not doing it correctly, but I think we would put in there something that ties it back to section 2.
Okay.
So could you, if you can come up with something there? And well, Madam Chair, I get your point. This is going to help finance. And so, Representative Loeffler, if we do something right here on the fly, we'll get it wrong.
Yes.
We'll work on it. We'll figure out some language, and we'll put it on when we take it to help finance, if that's okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lee, and thank you for graciously working this through.
All right. Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is just more of an observation, an op-ed to the dialogue that I've just been witness to. But we all already have Level 1, Level 2, and Level 3 trauma center hospitals. And people are familiar with that vernacular from a standpoint of what, obviously, level of service they would be provided. And if you're trying to not confuse the citizenry, why wouldn't you want to embrace that type of terminology as you look at stroke centers from a standpoint of level 1, level 2, level 3, because I will be candid with you. If I'm looking at the words comprehensive, primary, or acute, I really don't know what the differentiation is going to be between those three. But if you told me I was going to be taken to a level 1 stroke center versus a level 3, my impression is that level 1 is probably more of a triage versus a level 3 where I've got a serious situation, and I'm only going there because I'm the worst of the worst. So just an observation to maybe feed into the dialogue that the rest of you are going to have on this and for the research staff, but I'll leave it at that. But that would be just an op-ed from this side of the table on that point.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about something. A couple of the things I learned here. I heard am I correct that 1 million people in Minnesota do not have access to acute? Would it be acute stroke-ready hospitals?
Dr. Tsai or Ms. Lindsay? Dr. Tsai.
Madam Chair, Representative. Over a quarter of the state's population live over an hour away from a primary stroke center. And the primary stroke centers in Minnesota are primarily in the Twin Cities area and Rochester and Duluth. And so we know that this population has access to many very high-quality, acute, critical access hospitals, many of whom I would consider and we know meet the criteria already for an acute stroke-ready hospital. So that is not to say that these people don't have access to good quality care. This bill is just describing a way to ensure that that happens in all communities across the state.
Representative Johnson.
So am I to understand, Madam Chair, I have trouble with this. Am I to understand then that most hospitals that would have an emergency room would meet the criteria for acute stroke-ready hospital?
Dr. Tsai? Ms. Lindsay?
Yes, Madam Chair. That would be accurate that most hospitals with an emergency room would be capable of meeting these criteria. They would just have to put some processes in place, ensure that they have the appropriate drug available. And because they often lack neurologic expertise in the form of a neurologist, they lack the comfort in treating the patient. So obtaining education and perhaps setting up a relationship with a larger facility where they could obtain neurologic input should they feel that they need it.
Representative Johnson.
Yes, Madam Chair. Do you think there's a sufficient incentive in this that I'm looking at this map. This is on the American Heart Association. I'm seeing a lot of white space there that doesn't have access. Would one expect that that would diminish radically with this legislation so that additional hospitals in rural Minnesota would seek the primary stroke center, which would meet the criteria then of what you would think would be a, kind of a needed level for care?
Ms. Lindsay.
Madam Chair. We do believe that what that would allow us to do is to know for certain that the care is available in those areas. Right now, we believe that it's available, at least in some communities, but we don't have a standard to hold people to ensure that. This would allow us that standard so that, the emergency medical system would be clear on who has those capabilities and who doesn't. So if there is a site that doesn't, they would know to take the patient to the nearest site that could offer that care. And right now, there's no way for the EMS crews to know that except to physically go out and acquaint themselves with each site and learn that through experience. There's no true standard that anybody is held to other than the primary stroke centers that are certified through the Joint Commission, which are the ones that are primarily in the more urban areas.
Representative Johnson.
One last point, Madam Chair, and that is that I'm just speculating that when I'm looking at this map, I also look at a map that I think is elder, is old. And I would hope that that area can be covered. It would seem like that would be the primary focus for this sort of care. And I'll just also make a comment that I'm a little curious why that hasn't been done up to this point, because it would seem that hospitals in these areas would have recognized the need for quality care for strokes. And so I'm just curious why that's lagging, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just a few thoughts as we're going through this. As somebody who, at age 17, 3 days after my junior year of high school, suffered a stroke and was rushed to the nearest hospital to be treated, I think the life's, in my terms, made out of a series of miracles. And I think one for myself and our family was that I had my stroke in Elk River and was treated in Coon Rapids. And I wasn't up at my family's cabin on the lake where that prompt treatment wouldn't have been possible and wouldn't have been viable. And it's one thing to say that every hospital that has an ER can treat a stroke patient. They can, and they'll do what they can. But as we heard our testifiers say, as we heard Ms. Lindsay talk about, once you have protocols and standards in place, you get that treatment across the board. So even when you're in greater Minnesota, or even when you're somewhere that not in your home area where you don't feel comfortable, or maybe your family doesn't know where to direct you to go for care, there's a standard of care throughout this system, and that's what this is about. It's coordinating a stroke system across the state for a standard of care so that no matter where you are, when you fall victim to this, a stroke system across the state for a standard of care so that no matter where you are, when you fall victim to this ailment, that if not treated quickly and appropriately, will, if it doesn't end your life, will absolutely decimate your life and be extremely, extremely expensive to treat for the rest of your life. And so what we're looking for here is a standard of care across all, call it 1, 2, 3, call it whatever you want. The main thing is, and we can figure that out in an amendment, the main thing is we need this standard of care in Minnesota, and we need it as soon as possible.
Thank you, Representative Ross. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just echo those comments because I look back over my career in the nursing home 30 years ago, 20 years ago. You had a stroke, and we couldn't move our patients. We were told to let them stroke out. That should never happen. And this is very good legislation. We would be able now to someone my age, 67, 68 years old, I could actually go to the emergency room and possibly not be paralyzed or not able to speak or move. I'd be able to be treated soon enough. So this is about time. Thank you for bringing this forward.
Is there any other questions? Okay, any other one? Anyone else would like to testify? Okay, so Representative Leveland renews her motion that Health File 672 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
All right.
The committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.